Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Team-Ups and Crossovers by Marion G. Harmon. Narrated by Caitlin Kelly. Dating Games by Marion G. Harmon. In Hollywood, everything is about the image. But how is that different than life as a celebrity cape? Answer: it's not. And there are good people there too. We've just got to remember that the pretty wrapping is never the package. The Hope Corrigan interviews. Kitsune was stalking me. Actually, he was stalking my dates, which was worse. Tonight, she was our beautiful Asian waitress, Mei. I almost tucked my hands beneath me in an effort not to jump up and go find our real one, who was almost certainly peacefully sleeping in a closet somewhere. She'd wake up later to find she'd made the most amazing tips tonight, but I blinked. Sorry? My date had just asked, what? Had I seen his latest movie? Had I been to the movies lately? What did I think of movies? Super-duper hearing did no good if I wasn't paying attention. But it was my super-duper nose that had distracted me. I wasn't quite a bloodhound, but ever since the thing in Tokyo we never ever mention, I'd been able to recognize Kitsune by his smell. It was the same undertone of musky, furry something, no matter what form he wore. I'd learned to dread it, and with Mei standing by our table, I'd lost the tenuous thread of our limping conversation again. Tony kept his smile up, probably second nature in public where there might be paparazzi or anyone willing to sell a tidbit of observation to a tabloid.
I said, how's the Mushu?
Oh! I looked down at my plate. L.A. Silk Road served the authentic Mushu, sliced pork tenderloin, cucumber, and scrambled eggs together with thinly sliced wood ear and velvet foot mushrooms, all stir-fried in peanut oil and seasoned with minced ginger and garlic. I could taste the bite of the rice wine under the flavors. I bit my tongue before I said all that. Being reduced to talking about the food was a bad sign. And this was going to end epically badly. It was all Quinn's fault. After Jackie, Ozma, and I had arrived back from that place we do not speak of, I'd been benched for physical therapy. And after everything we'd been doing lately to give poor Quinn public relations fits, I'd felt I'd owed her and made the mistake of telling her so. She'd collected. Tony was date number 5, latest in my string of celebrity dates, and the highest on the scale of celebrity stardom so far. He did action movies and had the kind of long face that didn't look handsome until he smiled, and then your breath would catch. Quinn wanted me to be seen doing adult socializing while I was in L.A. to retrain and work back up with Rook. It was all part of her campaign against my wholesome teen sweetheart brand, which had never completely died despite my rumored romantic relationship with Atlas during my sidekick tour. It didn't help that I still looked like a wholesome teen sweetheart despite being just a couple months shy of 21, and that these dates were the most I'd agreed to do to mature my image. Quinn's other suggestion had been a costume makeover that would have made me look like a Victoria's Secret model in a catwalk costume, so here I was out on a date with Tony. Looking at his handsome, homely face as he took another bite of his fish, I wondered if he was regretting me. His agent had agreed because Tony's next movie was a superhero flick. Tony was playing a super-normal vigilante out after the supervillains who killed his family. There were rumors that the script was vaguely anti-cape, so the idea was that being seen with me would buff his pro-cape credentials. Celebrity actors shaped their public images even more carefully than capes did. Tony had agreed because the singer he'd been dating had dumped him after a drunken fight the tabloids were still telling conflicting stories about. I was beginning to think she should have maimed him on her way out. Sure, the guy had come off a long day on a soundstage, but he was putting as much energy into our conversation as a flat battery. Now he blinked slowly at me, and I realized I should be talking. Even Kitsune was looking at me a little funny. The Mushu's good. I smiled at Mei, because if she'd been her, I would have. And your fish? Tony had ordered the Szechuan fish, poached in hot chili oil.
I've had better.
His face said, from the food truck on the set. I barely kept from rolling my eyes. My nose told me the oil was pure and fresh, the fish practically teleported from its saltwater tank into the poaching pan before it had known it was dead. My father, the foodie, would have had nothing to complain about, except maybe the dish's mouthfeel. I bit my lip and didn't suggest he change his micro-brew beer. The original May hadn't recommended it with the fish, and it was probably swamping his taste buds. Kitsune didn't twitch even though it had been her question. And how is everything? That had sparked Tony's question to me, and obviously the word movie had come out of his mouth enough times before he'd gone quiet for me to swap it for Mushu. She smiled widely instead. Is there anything else I can get you, perhaps? I didn't close my eyes, groan, drop my head onto the table, or run screaming, although all of that sounded good, because Tony was a dead man walking. May departed with a smile when neither of us said we wanted anything, but it was only a matter of time. Tony was probably safer when she was standing right here. It had started with date number 3. 1 and 2 hadn't been teeth-achingly bad, although my opinion of actors as dateable human beings had suffered a little. Hopefully I wasn't getting top draw on the Hollywood dating circuit. Possibly the fact that I still looked like a before-the-makeover Disney princess scared them off. Regardless, numbers 3 and 4 had been bad. So bad I'd hoped that a supervillain attack would end the date since I couldn't stick a fork in my own eye. The dates had ended, and technically Kitsune was a supervillain. Number 3 had taken a bathroom break, and then suddenly and urgently had to leave, face-planting into another couple's table on the way out. I'd carried him out to the town car while our driver held the door, and the paparazzi had of course caught it. The opinion of the emergency room doctor, leaked to the tabloids, of course, had been too much coke during the bathroom break, and number 3 was now in rehab. Number 4 had caught on fire. Kitsune had attended the Hollywood house party as a minor celebrity. I had no idea where the real one had been. But he'd been standing nowhere near when it happened. The spilled alcohol fire hadn't hurt 4, but it had destroyed his suit and his dignity. He'd absolutely panicked instead of doing anything constructive, and I'd had to toss him in the mansion's pool. Again, caught on camera, this time another party guest's phone. And I still didn't know how Kitsune had done it. So part of me was waiting in sick fascination to see what doom would befall Tony, and wondering if I could keep it out of the tabloids. Who had realized something was happening and started placing bets? The other part of me was determined to grab Kitsune and make him explain how he was finding out about my dates, which were hardly publicized beforehand, and why he was destroying the bad ones. I picked at my mushu without tasting it. After all, in a weird sort of way, we were betrothed. And didn't that word just make me giggle half hysterically? I'd agreed to marry him at some unspecified future date, the same day that he carried out his promise to swear himself to the service of my family, like an old-style samurai retainer. So that was never going to happen. So why the stalking? And if he was staking some kind of sneaky claim, why end the bad dates? You'd think he'd shut down the good ones. Not that any of them had been exactly great. Sorry? I'd ignored Tony again. And he was just watching me, looking for what I didn't know. Then a half-smile crept across his face.
This is terrible, isn't it?
His lips twitched and his eyes, which really were tired, invited me to share the joke. My face went hot. I hadn't been the most conversationally engaged date either, not since sniffing Kitsune. A little? I'm sorry. He snorted and leaned in, elbows on the table and hands clasped under his chin.
Don't say it. This is my fault. I never should have agreed to a night when I'm not firing on all cylinders. And this can't be you. I talked to 7 before telling my agent to go ahead and set it up. So both of us are failing to prop up this thing, though you gave it a great shot in the beginning. Yeah?
I deflated. Okay, yeah. This is pretty bad.
Then how about this? We doggy bag our dinner.
We
Really? They know me here, and I'm usually much better than this, trust me. They'll box our entrees, slip some tasty dessert into the bag, even include the linen and silver. They know I'm good for it.
His half-smile went full bore, much more real than the earlier photo-op one.
I know a nice little park in the hills not far away. It's a warm night. I can take off this hangman's tie and jacket. And if we can't start a better conversation in 5 minutes out there, you can ditch your excuse of a date. What do you say? There are ducks.
Well, if there are ducks... That twisty grin had talked a lot of girls into bigger things than ducks. I was sure of it. But it sounded fun. And away from our audience. I was suddenly hyper-aware of the clink of cutlery on china, the low rumble and susurration of a dozen dinner conversations around us. Everybody at the Silk Road, guests and staff, had been super great about ignoring us. It was one of the high-end establishment's best-selling points, I supposed, but it wouldn't continue when doom befell. If I could get Tony out of here intact, away from Kitsune... I nodded hard, a matching grin splitting my face. I'm in. Let me tell May. An undoomed date. The thought made me almost giddy.
Time to pay your dues, oppressors!
You have got to be kidding me. The guys in the black bandanas and hoodies fanning out from the kitchen weren't staff, and the guns and bags they carried weren't aperitifs. The dinner conversations turned into dismayed shouts and screams, but nobody got stupid as the intruders pushed through the dining room. They wore black armbands decorated with broken red A's, the anarchists' favored symbol, on their right arms. 8 of them, all armed. How was I supposed to stop them without someone getting hurt? Shell? I whispered, and got nothing. She stayed out of my head on these dates. Her commentary was monumentally distracting, but a shout through our quantum neural link should have gotten her attention. So either one of the wannabe anarchist redistributors was a superhuman somehow jamming me, or they'd bought a universal blocker off a black lab Vern, and it was working even better than they knew. And if they had Vern tech jammers, what else did they have? Moving very slowly, I slipped fingers into my purse and withdrew the pair of anonymity specs Ozma had let me bring to L.A. With her sense of humor, she'd made these look exactly like the kinds of big, dark shades Hollywood stars tended to wear with baseball caps when trying to avoid notice. Mine worked.
Thanks for giving.
The hooded thug looming by our table grabbed my bag and the specs in one big gloved fist, stuffed them into his sack. Then he shoved the gun in my face, eyes on Tony.
Hey, calm down, action hero. There's no retakes on this scene. Hate to end it with your little slut's brain spread over your entree. Phone, watch, ring, wallet, money clip, now!
He raised his gun like he was going to pistol whip me with it.
Okay, okay.
Tony held up both hands.
Don't do anything.
He carefully reached into his jacket and pulled out his wallet, phone, and cash. Pulled off his ring and unlatched his watch, dropping everything in the sack. His hands were steady and his breathing deep, like he was gathering oxygen for extra energy. His heart was racing, but not with the tripping speed of panic. He was ready to do something. Please, nobody needs to get hurt, I whispered, keeping my eyes on him.
Effing right, girl!
Our robber purred at me, looking me over. I'd raided Beverly Hills Rodeo Drive shops for tonight, and was wearing a bustier dress with glittery top and a skirt almost short and poofy enough for a ballerina. With tights, of course. The miracle had been that it was in my elfin size, but I'd picked it mostly because back-crossing straps supported the bustier. If I got in a fight wearing this confection, there would be zero wardrobe accidents. Now I felt like I was wearing too little. His pistol dropped and I shivered as he used its tip to push the ends of my bobbed hair off my shoulders. Please, I repeated, thinking faster than I ever had. There could easily be one superhuman in this hooded gang. First rule of being a professional supervillain. Unless you're trying to make a point, don't identify yourself with a flashy costume when you're actually on the job. You just give someone like me a target and a chance of knowing exactly what you can do if you have any real rep. You saved the costume for hanging with your minions and peeps.
He let my hair drop without a flicker, or panicked freakout, of recognition, and I slumped with relief. Of course he misread it.
Maybe we'll get acquainted later.
He tossed off as he moved to the next table. Nobody else looked at us, and that was getting weird. The dining room's lights were kind of dim, but it wasn't like the tabloids hadn't been spreading my unmasked face around recently. But none of the guests or staff were giving me a save-us look either. And that was just against human nature. I'd put being ignored before down to LA society politeness. Now it was freaky. Which didn't mean it wasn't good, since I didn't want these social justice redistributionists to panic and spring into hostage mode. There were too many to protect, and I could all too easily picture someone else's brain spread over the white tablecloths. And I didn't even want to see theirs there, no matter how rude they got. Our robber moved on from our neighbor's table, leaving the nice older couple there more than a little shaky. I really hoped it wasn't their anniversary or something, and worried about the lady. She looked unhealthily pale and wasn't breathing well. But this was okay. It would be okay if everyone just kept ignoring me. Our robbers could sweep the room and switch to getaway mode, and then I could pursue with nobody to get hurt. I wasn't a local cape, but it was legal so long as I didn't lose contact. I'd get somebody even if they dispersed on the streets. Turn him over to the LAPD if they just...
No! No!
The panicked cry came from the man eating alone three tables away, and our personal robber clubbed him with the pistol he'd waved at me. Screams spread as the man, halfway to his feet when the heavy weight met his head, crashed to the dining room floor, and his attacker pointed his gun. And still, nobody looked at me until I launched myself with no time even for a prayer.
Everybody down! Everybody down! Everybody down!
And the lights went out, which didn't slow me down at all. I hit the would-be shooter hard, carrying him over the table and into the next closest. Dropped him, but not before crushing his gun hand while disarming him. At least he still had his fingers. Silk Road's patrons and staff followed my screamed instructions, but the anarchists didn't. They stayed on their feet, nice glowing targets in the black illuminated by their body heat in my super-duper vision. I collected and scattered guns, calling on them to surrender every time I bobbed up to give them something to focus on and shoot at in their blindness. The smart ones tried to run, also stupid since they couldn't see. But none of them shot down. Even so, my heart stayed in my throat the entire time, and I didn't breathe except to keep shouting for their attention over the bangs and screams until the last of the seven were down and the crashing chaos died. And the lights came back. It was a wreckage, but not, thank God, a bloody one. The seven had joined everyone else on the floor. I dropped each hard when I emptied their hands and left them broken wrists or crushed hands for good measure. And I didn't see any injured patrons. I settled to an upright table in the center of the dining room, feeling lightheaded. Everybody wearing a hoodie will stay on the floor, and if you move, I'll hang you from the ceiling. Would everyone else please move to the walls? I'm sorry for the fright you've been given. Tony rose from where he'd obviously, with care and foresight, gotten our neighboring couple to the floor and then crouched over them. Now he helped them up and away, as staff began remembering themselves and doing the same. Some of the less shaken ones even picked up dropped guns as they moved away from my targets. I couldn't see May, but then I didn't expect to. She would be somewhere with the lights if she wasn't gone now. And I forgot about her and tried to look menacing. Not easy to do standing on a table in my kicky shoes and sparkly dress, but I'd just inflicted serious pain on all of them, and their monkey hindbrains wouldn't forget that soon. And I could hear sirens. Minutes later, the dining room flooded with half a dozen blue boys, and I climbed down. Tony helped me, a totally pointless and very nice gesture. "Excuse me," I called to our maitre d', a bit pale himself. He did seem to at least be tracking things. "Have you seen May?" He stopped giving the staff quiet orders and drew breath, looking around the dining room,
No, not since these men arrived.
I sighed. Look in your supply closets, but I'm sure she's fine.
Thank you.
He nodded and dismissed my bizarre suggestion, but he'd remember it as soon as he had a moment. I was sure of that. Tony chuckled beside me.
Do I want to know?
Not really. I recognized the expression on the officer headed towards me, and sighed again. Debriefing time. Turning to Tony, I looked him over. His jacket was rumpled and he'd loosened his hangman's noose, but he was still in better shape than numbers 3 and 4. And he'd acquitted himself surprisingly well back there.
I can't believe I'm going to ask this, but would you like another date? A do-over?
His half-smile spread to full, without a trace of irony or sarcasm, as he looked around at the trashed room and back at me. I'll need to check my insurance, but sure. He could be number 6. Document 43.5284, recovered text file. 2 Blackstone. I'm sure you've received the official police report. I'll write it up tomorrow and explain whatever doesn't make sense in the debriefing when I get back. After searching all of the anarchists, turned up no Vern Tech, I discreetly spoke to the Maitre D' about signals jamming and mental manipulation, and he privately confessed that the Silk Road employs a high-priced witch to maintain anti-eavesdropping and anonymity charms to shield the restaurant's patrons from unwanted surveillance or attention. I don't think he knows how powerful they are, but they explained my weird anonymity and shell silence, and they're harmless enough that I promised not to tell anyone official. I do recommend Ozma look at them and write up the basic technique of the anonymity charm for the DSA to know about without telling them where it came from. Banking some favors with Veritas and his people may pay dividends later. Speaking of Veritas and favors, he's called and asked me to join a special DSA-CAI task force trying to trap a superhuman serial killer. I said yes, and I'm leaving LA tonight, so Quinn's celebrity dating scheme will have to wait. Please tell her that I've let Tony know and that I look forward to seeing the ducks when I return. Sincerely, Hope. Killing Sleeping Beauty by Marion G. Harmon. The problem with making yourself the sword of justice is knowing when to stop chopping. Jackie Bouchard, a.k.a. Artemis. He was trouble in a cop suit. Looking up at the ringing of the shop silver bell and seeing him push his way into Beantown made me reconsider my open-door policy. Not that I didn't like Detective Paul Negri, but since I'd slipped from being on the side of the angels, or at least the law, the New Orleans Police Department and I didn't have much to do with each other. I'd fallen from grace when I became the completely deniable enforcer for the Midnight Ball. New Orleans' completely deniable vampire familia, headed by the master of ceremonies. And Paul was too much of a straight arrow to not take my defection personally. Not that I'd had any real choice. At 3 in the afternoon, tourists and locals packed the small coffee house. I'd been up for 2 hours, and sat at my office table where I could watch over things while working on the shop's books on my e-pad and sampling our latest delivery of Ethiopian shade bean. He ignored the serving counter to push through the close-packed little tables to my corner. Paul? I lowered my cup, careful to set it on its Beantown coaster. I hadn't named the place Beantown for Boston, but tourists from New England loved to buy them. Eduardo appeared at Paul's elbow with a peeler's cup, the special house blend we complimented to any officers of the law who crossed our door. Half of the uniforms on night patrol in the French Quarter dropped by at least once a night for theirs. "How are you, Cher?" he asked as soon as Eduardo left. "Emerson send you?" he winced. My accusing him of being here on orders from his boss was probably unfair, but he hadn't exactly earned fairness.
"It's good to see you, Jackie."
"You too. Emerson send you?" I put an impatient edge in my voice, but looked past his head.
I wasn't being rude. Eye contact magnified a vampire's influence, and I wasn't going to push him, even accidentally. He sipped his peeler's cup, grimaced. The stuff was bitter and strong, meant to shock the half-asleep mind awake and set the drinker's nerves dancing. It wasn't drunk for pleasure, though a lot of uniforms had told me there wasn't anything else like it once they'd gotten used to it. Kind of like fang addicts.
I need your help.
Putting the cup down, he reached into his blazer jacket and slid his cell phone across the table. Its screen showed a raven-haired, fresh-faced young girl, 15 or 16. She looked happy. I studied her.
A case? I wish.
He crossed himself, something he always did when saying a prayer in his head. A prayer for her, I assumed. Which saint had he invoked?
Her name is Sabrina Garnett.
I'm just a PI these days, Paul. I do security, bodyguarding, private investigations. Which of those do you want?
All three, cher. But it can't be a job.
He managed to look both annoyed and shamed. Quite a trick, and the conversation lost what little pleasure it had. Midnight ball business. The words tasted sour. If Lieutenant Emerson and his team were going to lock me out, sending Paul to negotiate a favor was just shitty. Damn it, Paul. He held up his hand.
Please, Cher. The boss didn't send me. If he knew I was talking to you, it would be worth my badge.
I didn't believe that for a second. The ruthless bastard probably knew right where Paul was, just not officially. Which meant if whatever this was came to light officially and in a bad way, then Paul would be the one to take it in the teeth instead of his rat boss. Realizing I was showing fang, I got a grip. Lieutenant Emerson was a rat and a lot of other things, but he was a good rat. He did what he thought he had to do to protect the people in his precinct, and most of the time, he was right. Okay, Paul. Tell me what your boss can't tell me. He accepted that.
The girl's got a friend who's got her back. Her parents sure don't. They're a business couple, out of town half the time. The girl practically raises herself.
Great. The perfect target for the kind of trouble I usually got called by the master of ceremonies to straighten out. The cops making the call was new. Seems lively. So her friend thinks she's in trouble, but can't prove it? He nodded.
She's smart. Spotted all the signs. Course, Miss Garnett could just be getting into drugs. Just about the same social cues. But she's gotten into goth, too.
Shit. And what have you done?
We interviewed her. But we've got no proof she went anywhere she shouldn't. And without it, we can't get a warrant for a physical or psychological examination.
One that might show evidence of bites or repeated enthrallment. I looked at her picture again. Behavior changes?
Plenty, according to her friend. She reported her anonymously.
I was beginning to like her friend. Most girls that age wouldn't be observant enough, thoughtful enough, and then strong enough to figure out something was seriously wrong and take steps that amounted to narking. The unpardonable teen sin. If that's what this was. If it was, then she'd probably try to intervene herself first. Depending on Sabrina's degree of enthrallment, if that's what it was, the results could have been scary as hell.
We put a watch on her place for a couple of weeks, Paul went on. But she's not sneaking out, and we don't have the manpower to keep it up. With nothing to use.
With nothing concrete. They couldn't go in to look for more. Glancing up from the phone, I caught Paul's expression before he smoothed it out. He was resentful, worried, tired. Obviously, the 2 weeks watchman. I handed the phone back. I'll talk to some people, Paul. That's all.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?